Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 6, 2006. Today's session is entitled Stem Cells and Cloning, presented by Jan Schulepe, number CH-JA-2006-08. Let's listen in.
For a company called Amgen. It's a biotech slash pharmaceutical company based in California, but I work in their Seattle site. And today we're going to talk about stem cells and we're going to talk about cloning. And there are relationships between the two topics. But we'll start with stem cells. Stem cells are in the news a lot, right? They're controversial. And there are a lot of reports about what they can be used to treat as far as illnesses and diseases. So, but what are they? There are special things about stem cells that are not true of other cells in our bodies. They are unspecialized or undifferentiated cells that renew themselves for long periods through cell division. So whereas a skin cell is specialized to just do the job being skin, being a barrier to outside objects, and a heart muscle cell does the job of heart muscle beating to keep your blood pumping, stem cells are cells that have the potential to differentiate, depending on what kind of signals they receive, to differentiate into more specialized tissues. And they renew themselves through cell division over long periods of time. And that's important too, because if you have, think about blood cells or heart muscle cells, they do renew them, they do divide for a certain period of time, but not for long periods of time. They have to be replaced in some way by stem cells in your body. And the second special characteristic of stem cells is that under certain physiologic or experimental conditions, they can be induced to become cells with specialized functions, such as the beating cells of the heart muscle or the insulin-producing cells of the pancreas. So that's what's special about them. It's different from more differentiated cells in your body that just do have one specific function, and they've sort of matured, and that's the one thing they do, and you can't stimulate them to change their function. And there are two types of stem cells, and this doesn't get mentioned much. When you read about stem cells in the paper or you hear something on the news, they don't really say anything much about those stem cells. They often don't specify what type of stem cell they're talking about, but there are two types. The embryonic stem cells, which are derived from embryos, or more correctly, from blastocysts, so a stage of development that's pre what you would really call embryo. There's kind of a continuum of development from the time the sperm and egg come together and the egg is fertilized. That entity is called a zygote, and that begins to divide over and over until it forms kind of a hollow ball of cells that are all identical, and that's called a blastocyst. And that's at what stage embryonic stem cells are derived. And then days or weeks later, that blastocyst continues to develop to the stage where it's called an embryo.
Say that it's in the future and they've developed from embryonic stem cells cures for these diseases. Would there be any chance of that rejection phenomenon that occurs with like bone marrow transplants and stuff?
Well, that's why if you were trying to stimulate growth of a certain type of tissue for yourself, you would try to make an embryonic stem cell line from your own tissues. We'll get into that more when we talk about cloning and how the cloning procedure is done. Because you can't do the sperm and egg thing because then you're getting genetic information from another individual that's going to recombine and make a completely unique individual. If you want stem cell that's completely and clonally you. You have to do it. You have to generate that blastocyst in a different manner.
And if you had a hereditary disease, you might put it off coming back again, but it still would come back because.
It depends on, in that case, you would want to look for a matched donor to generate the stem cells from. Yeah, that would be recognized, that would have enough similarity to you to be recognized as self by your immune system, but not have the misspelling, the genetic defect. Yeah. So the blastocyst, the cells continue to divide and get to a stage called the gastrula, where there are a lot more cells, and by this point, the cells have begun to differentiate into ectoderm, mesoderm, endoderm, and germ cells. And all the things that control this differentiation, this is the whole field of developmental biology. How does this happen, that all these cells that were essentially identical in this blastocyst have somehow begun to communicate to each other, change what genes they turn on and off, and begin to change from unspecialized stem cells into cells that are more specialized that then go on to develop into all the organs and tissues in our body. So for instance, ectoderm, that's kind of your external layer, so that develops into skin cells, neurons, and pigment cells, whereas mesoderm, being the middle layer, develops into muscle of all sorts, cardiac, skeletal, the tubule cells of the kidney, the red blood cells, muscle in your gut. Endoderm, meaning the internal layer, develops into pancreas, thyroid, lung cells. The germ cells, of course, are sperminate, depending on whether you're male or female. And those develop in a special way.
Sorry, what did you just say, the name of that, after the blastocyst was?
Gastrula.
Gastrula.
And I'm going to pass this around if people want to take a copy. If you don't want one, you can just pass it on. And you can look at them for this session and give them back. Keep them, or you can keep them if you want to keep them. So that's just a diagram of development.
So if nerve cells are whatever the outside layer is, does that mean that the brain is too? That it develops from
the ectoderm, yeah.
Really?
So there are also adult stem cells. So that's an undifferentiated cell found among the differentiated cells in a tissue or organ that can renew itself and can differentiate to yield the major specialized cell types of that specific tissue or organ. So for instance, in the blood, in the bone marrow, there are stem cells that can repopulate all the cells in the blood. And so that's what bone marrow transplant tries to accomplish, to get enough of those stem cells from the bone marrow to repopulate the bone marrow of the person with leukemia with healthy cells that can differentiate into all the different kinds of blood cells. So whichever type of blood cells they had that were cancerous would be repopulated with healthy. So if it's leukemia, it's cancer, one of the white blood cell types. So the sick person's own bone marrow is ablated and destroyed by chemotherapy and radiation. And then they're given bone marrow from a healthy donor that's hopefully genetically matched close enough so that the recipient's body won't reject that, and that transplanted bone marrow will begin to grow in the bones of the recipient and repopulate all the cells of the blood. And further research is suggesting that there are stem cells in other organs as well that can repopulate the cells of that organ. So that gives the hope that one could find, if it was your heart muscle that had been damaged, say, by a heart attack, that if you could find that if there are stem cells in the heart muscle, if one could isolate those from an individual and stimulate them to regrow into healthy heart tissue, you could use your own adult stem cells for those kind of things instead of having to go the embryonic stem cell route. But this is all still very much work in progress. Embryonic stem cells are more easily grown in culture than adult stem cells are for reasons that are not completely understood. It's not completely understood what kind of specific substances these cells need to see to really get all the nutrients they need to grow. It's not completely understood what signals turn specific genes on and off to influence the differentiation of stem cells into one tissue or another. I mean, we don't know enough now to take it, even an embryonic stem cell, and get it to differentiate into every type of tissue in the body. But that's one of the reasons that a lot of people in research, and even people that aren't in research, want to see stem cell research continue, so that those kind of discoveries can be made, and that we could potentially use stem cells to treat people with Parkinson's disease, or muscular dystrophy, or any of a host of diseases that involve specific tissues becoming sick and unable to do the functions that they need to keep us healthy. So potential uses of stem cells, we've already touched on treating disease and generation of cells and tissues for therapy or for transplant. Studying stem cells could also potentially give us a greater understanding of human development that might potentially aid in learning more about how birth defects occur, how to prevent birth defects, or how to treat them after they've occurred.
There's a question about the embryonic stem cells. You hear a lot about that kind of thing. When they use stem cells from an embryonic, is it the embryo a waste then, or can it grow on its own? I guess mainly that's the big question, along with the fact that I know there's a lot of uproar about using embryos for that kind of thing. What is the problem with that? Is it that the embryo dies after they do that, or what?
Yeah, so if you take the embryonic stem cells from the blastocyst, you basically disrupt the blastocyst to get those. So the blastocyst is no longer viable. So you destroy the blastocyst. So
then it becomes, I guess, a question of what is considered
Where does life begin? Okay. Is the blastocyst, should a blastocyst be considered equal to a fully formed human life? It's a real continuum from the zygote to the the fully formed organism that is born. So that's a big ethical question. Where do you draw that line? The majority of stem cell lines have been made from blastocysts that are left over from in vitro fertilization procedures. So those blastocysts are sitting in freezers somewhere, potentially never to be used. If the folks that generated them in order to become pregnant because of fertility problems have successfully become pregnant and had children, and may not be interested in, because you always generate way more blastocysts than you actually implant in the female to get the greatest chance of success.
So the leftovers are
often thrown away.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah, so then it becomes a question of, is it better to use them for medical research rather than to discard them? Or are both things equally wrong? So that's one of the big ethical dilemmas of embryonic stem cells. Although you can argue that the dilemma is there, whether they're used for stem cells or not, at least part of the dilemma, what happens to those blastocysts?
Yeah.
There have even been court cases fought over blastocysts in a freezer.
There have, yeah.
So, for instance, a man and woman, the woman has fertility problems, and so they do in vitro fertilization, she becomes pregnant, the extra blastocysts go in the freezer. Later on, the man and woman divorce, she remarries and wants to have children again, but it's a very grueling procedure for a woman to go through in vitro fertilization. You're stimulated with all sorts of hormones, and then it's an invasive procedure to go into the ovary and harvest eggs. So she doesn't want to go through that again. She wants to use the blastocysts that are in the freezer from the time before. It's also very costly. It costs thousands of dollars.
Oh, sure.
But her ex-husband says, no, I don't want to be, I'll be the biological father of those children, even if I'm not the one raising them. And I choose not to be the biological father of any more of your children.
Okay.
what happens there,
yeah.
You know. Who gets custody of the frozen blastocyst. And, you know, that we don't have a lot of laws governing these things yet. Sort of as they come up in court, they're dealt with, and precedents are set for the next court case, but there's not a, really a governing body that oversees these kind of things in this country. Okay, so that's... that's what stem cells are, and what they can be used for. Oh, another potential use is for testing new drugs. So drugs are tested in this country. A lot of testing is done at the cellular level in vitro, so that means in a dish, in a laboratory, not in an organism. So you can learn a certain number of things about a drug, how cells are affected by that drug, by having cells in culture in a laboratory dish. But it doesn't equal what is really going on in the organism, which is a far more complex set of chemical processes and biological processes. And so drugs, by law, have to be tested in organisms before they're tested in humans. So that usually means mice or rats. By law, you have to do that to get FDA approval to go into clinical trials in humans. But if one could... develop cell lines of every type of tissue, because we have a lot of cell lines at the present, and I'll get into that a little bit when I talk about what a clone is, but we have a lot of cell lines that are, say, a B cell line, that's a type of white blood cell, or a T cell line, another type of white blood cell, skin cell lines, but we don't have good cell lines for every type of tissue. So stem cells, if we knew enough about how to make them differentiate into every type of tissue, we could potentially develop better cell lines to test drugs on, or if we knew enough to get them to not only develop into a specific type of tissue, but to start to form an organ, that would be a much better way to test drugs. You would learn a lot more. It would be more what we say in research as physiologically relevant. It's closer to what's really in the person when you give them the drug. So that would be another thing that stem cells could be used for. So cloning, mostly I want to talk about whole organism cloning, but I just want to point out what a clone is. A clone is an exact or identical genetic copy of something. So a gene can be cloned. That's just a short stretch of DNA that encodes a protein. Many genes have been cloned. Now, insulin now, if you take insulin, or if you know someone who takes insulin, insulin used to be isolated from the pancreas of pigs and given to people to treat diabetes. And that worked okay, but pig insulin is not exactly the same as human insulin. It's not the exact same proteins. You know, they're obviously quite what's called homologous, quite similar, but not exactly the same. So when the human gene that encodes human insulin was cloned, then that can be put into bacteria, and bacteria are basically used as a factory for producing lots and lots of human insulin, and that's what is used now to treat people. So that's an example of a gene that's been cloned, and the protein product's been used as a drug treatment. Cells can be cloned. So if you take a cell from a person and you get that single cell to divide and divide and divide and divide, each of those cells is genetically identical to the cell that they were derived from. So that's a cloned cell line. Those cells are all genetically identical. And we use those a lot in research. And many times these are cancer cell lines because, again, we're still learning what cells need to live outside the body. So if you take somebody's blood and you isolate white blood cells from that blood, they'll survive for a certain number of days in culture, but then they'll die. Whereas transformed or cancerous white blood cells, they don't need all the stuff that normal white blood cells do because they're kind of growing out of control. They've got some genes that are either turned off or turned on super high, depending on the type of gene, that allow them to just divide and divide and divide kind of out of control. So that's what causes cancer, which is bad. But it does allow scientists to isolate those type of cells and grow them in culture quite easily. So we use those a lot in research. Clone cell lines, many of which are what's called transformed, meaning they come from cancerous tissue from a patient. But whole organism cloning is really the cloning that sets off, the type of cloning that sets off the ethical issues, like cloning of an entire organism. So I'm gonna pass around another handout, and hopefully there are enough where people can share that the diagrams how this type of cloning is done. So in this first category shows normal development, where sperm and egg meet, form a zygote, blastocyst, implantation into a uterus. So this is in vitro fertilization, but with an egg from one individual and a sperm from another individual. So you're not making a clone here, you're making a completely genetically unique individual. Whereas cloning, you want that individual organism to be genetically identical to whatever the organism is that you want to clone. Okay, so if you've got a cow that produces tons of milk and you want to clone this cow and have a whole herd of this cow that's all genetically identical, you don't want to just take the egg from that cow and mix it with sperm from some bull, because you're not going to get a clone that way. So what you do is you take an adult cell from that cow, and you take the nucleus out of that cell, and then you take an egg cell, and you take the nucleus out of the egg, and you put the nucleus from this adult cell, from the organism you want to clone, into this enucleated egg, and then you have to kind of stimulate that egg to divide, which is usually done by giving it a few zaps of electricity. It's been shown to somehow stimulate cell division. And not all of these processes are completely understood why that does that. But so this is happening in a way that does not happen when sperm meets egg. So I'll just pass this around. And then, so you've got the egg. It looks better in color, sorry. Color copying is really expensive, so I just did black and white. So now you've got this egg that has the nucleus from this other cell, which is the organism you're trying to clone, and you get it to divide, and it forms this blastocyst. So now, at this stage, you do the same thing for either therapeutic cloning or reproductive cloning. So therapeutic cloning is used to generate stem cells. So for therapeutic cloning, you would take the blastocyst at this stage, disassociate the cells, and grow them in culture and study them and try and figure out how to get them to divide and differentiate into different types of tissue. So that's where the process stops when you're trying to generate stem cells. If you want to generate an entire fully formed organism that's a clone of this organism you took the nucleus from, then you implant these blastocysts into a pseudo-pregnant female, a female that you've kind of injected with some hormones to get the body to think it's pregnant. You implant this blastocyst, hope that it takes and grows to a fully developed, viable offspring. So that's the procedure. And let's see. I've listed the species that have been cloned this way to date. So there's sheep, cow, mouse, pig, mule, cat, monkey, rabbit, guar, goat, and dog. A guar is a, if I remember correctly, it's some kind of endangered species of antelope. And so it was cloning, one of the potential uses for cloning is to save endangered species. And so then it was implanted, I believe, into an ox or some related species, and then delivered. And there are a lot of ethical issues on that front. You know, is it better to pour money into habitat preservation or try to save these animals by cloning? You know, cloning, you lose the genetic diversity, right? If you have a whole bunch of some kind of animal that's all exactly genetically the same, and a disease comes along that they're susceptible to, there goes your dairy herd. You know, it's the same with corn or potatoes or whatever. If you have something that's bred so for certain characteristics and everything's so identical, you really run a risk.
Is the therapeutic type of cloning for stem cells, how does that relate to the two types of stem cells that you have over there? Is that
those are the embryonic stem cells, yeah, because they're derived from blastocysts. So last year, there was big, or 2004, boy, time flies. In 2004, there was big news from South Korea about South Korean scientists succeeding in making human embryonic stem cells in this manner, which had never been done before. Later on, it was shown that there were some ethical issues and some fraudulent claims made there, so the playing field sort of leveled, so to speak, and everybody's still trying to see if, not everybody, but people who are interested in this research are still trying to see if they can do it. But one of the interesting things that the Korean scientists who did this mentioned in this article was that, Huang, who's one of the, Woo Suk Huang, is one of the scientists, said his experience producing cloned animals that were born with gross deformities has convinced the team that the process should be used only to try to cure diseases, never to create human babies. When cloning cows and pigs, Huang found that roughly 30% suffered from deformities that included heart defects, livers fivefold larger than normal, and brain abnormalities. Reproductive cloning in humans must be prohibited by law. It is public common sense, Wong said. So it's a fairly artificial process that produces this blastocyst and these stem cells, and it's not exactly like what happens when sperm meets egg and the sperm penetrates the egg and leaves its nucleus behind and development continues. So there seems to be quite a very high probability of getting abnormalities. You know, 30%, that's pretty bad. If 30% of human babies were born with gross deformities or abnormalities, that would be really a really serious health problem.
Just one more question. On the do you have a sense of, from, you know, you being in the field of microbiology, do you have a sense why there seems to be a lack of will in this country to, say, like, take a step and say, oh, have a law against cloning humans? I mean, I can understand some of the other issues farther and down the scale, but do you have a sense for why that is, or is that changing? Is there efforts being made to try to give us scientists in terms of figuring out the ethical issues and where we want to go with this?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, part of the problem is it's a very technical issue, and a lot of people don't feel they have the knowledge to weigh in on the discussion. And there is such a variety of opinion in this country as well. Now, there have been some bodies formed to try and come up with some policies. Scientists themselves have formed a group, and I can't remember what it's called, but to try and hash out some policies along these lines.
Have there been religious leaders involved in those two?
In some cases, yes. I have some literature from the ELCA that outlines some of their positions on this type of research. The U.S. is so much about the individual, right? And there are so many groups politically, ethnically, religious, along religious lines, that it's hard to get a consensus. You know, President Bush certainly has his feelings about this, mm-hmm. and he has outlawed stem cell research, through any federally funded entity, except on the cell lines that already exist, which are not that many. You know, there's a dozen or so. So scientists don't really like that. But privately funded entities can pretty much do what they will. So a number of universities have been trying to set up privately funded research arms that would work on some of these in these areas, looking at stem cells and trying to learn more about how they work. And Dolly the sheep died earlier than the average sheep. She developed rheumatoid arthritis and died earlier than sheep usually die. And you know, on the basis of one animal, you can't really draw conclusions, but I think that cloning, as the South Korean scientist mentioned, he's a veterinary scientist and works in a group that's done quite a bit of cloning of pigs and cows and such, and you know, based on a lot much larger sample pool, comes up with the 30% finding, 30% that have gross abnormalities. Another problem, or potential problem, with making blastocysts in this manner, so instead of having a sperm and egg each contribute half the genetic material, you're taking the nucleus from what's called a somatic cell, which is any cell besides a sperm and an egg. So a sperm and egg only have one half the number of chromosomes. They only have 23, one of each. And when they combine, then you get two of each, which is what all the rest of the cells in our body have, two copies of every chromosome. That's the full complement of chromosomes for a human. So you're taking a nucleus from a fully differentiated cell that has 46 chromosomes, and you're putting that into an egg. And so that cell has been around longer than an egg or a sperm cell has. And there's something at the end of the chromosomes called telomeres, which is a long sequence of DNA. And as cells divide, that sequence gets shorter. And that's believed, and again, this is an active area of research, you know, many things not known, but that's believed to be part of what causes the aging process, that those telomeres get shorter and shorter at the ends of the chromosomes as the individual ages. So you're sort of starting with quote-unquote old DNA, DNA that's been around for a while and divided a few times, and they have shorter telomeres. So that's another thing that's believed to potentially cause problems in these blastocysts that are developed in this way through therapeutic cloning. So potential uses of therapeutic cloning: save endangered species, resurrect extinct species, because you can get DNA out of bones and things that have been preserved over a long period of time. Did everyone see Jurassic Park? That's what they did in Jurassic Park, right? They took the DNA from dinosaurs, extinct for millions of years. And of course, they didn't get a whole genome with no breaks in it or anything, because these, you know, some of the DNA is degraded over these millions of years. So they substituted in, I believe it was amphibian DNA, into those other, and so they had problems, of course. It didn't work very well. But there have been some groups that have been trying to resurrect, for instance, woolly mammoths, whose bones have been preserved in the cold for thousands of years. Not as long as, you know, woolly mammoths were around when humans were around. They became extinct much later than dinosaurs. So anyway, it's possible to use. You could argue whether that's a good use of funding or not. And then to duplicate one organism with certain desirable characteristics, like a cow that produces high-quality milk, or a cat that's lacking the protein that causes an allergic response in humans. Those cats are available. You can buy them for $30,000. If you really want a cat and you're allergic to cats, you can buy a cat that does not produce the protein, because it's a protein that gets on the hair of the cat that is what's the major cause of allergy in humans. And so one of the problems then is, you know, loss of genetic diversity. And we face that problem already just by breeding. We breed animals already for specific characteristics, right? We just didn't know enough to pick them out at the genetic level or have the technology to be able to do so. We have multiple species of dogs. And there are problems in some of those dogs. They're bred for certain shape of the body, and then, you know, like the tiny hips, and then they have hip dysplasia a lot. Or the very pointy skull, and their brains get a little squished, and they're not as maybe smart as other dogs. You know, but if you keep breeding them for a skinny head, you know, the brain gets smaller and smaller. There's, you know, no less room. We breed plants the same way, corn that's resistant to certain things.
That's not actual cloning though, is it? It's like crossbreeding.
Right. So it's selecting for specific characteristics, but it's not through cloning, right? Through selective breeding. But just to make the point that we've been selecting for specific characteristics for a long period of time, but that's not the same thing as producing a clone, which would be genetically identical. And I need to remember to mention that we have genetically identical human beings on the planet already. That occur naturally, identical twins, right?
We have two.
So a human clone can occur in a quote-unquote natural way, and that happens when the sperm and the egg fuse, and that egg, instead of dividing into the over and over and forming the blastocyst, the first division, the two separate. They don't remain attached. And then they continue to divide, and so you get two blastocysts that are genetically identical instead of one, and they each develop into an individual person. And those, most of us probably know some identical twins. Their personalities are not identical, right? They're individuals. Even though genetically they're clones, they're unique individuals. So it's not all in the genes, right? It's our environment, and other things that we don't even completely understand. Identical twins that grow up in the same household still have very different personalities, and they're in a very similar environment, although two bodies can't occupy the exact same space, right? So even if you grow up in the same household, your environment is not exactly the same. And some of their sameness is genetic. Of course, they look the same. And identical twins that have been given up for adoption and adopted by two separate families have been studied extensively as adults. And it turns out they usually have a number of things in common. You know, like they both love to ride horses and they've both chosen professions along those lines. Or one's become a nurse and one's become a researcher at a hospital or something. You know, they find the same things funny. So some of it's genetic and some of it's not. So where I'm going with this is if that one was to clone a human, so if I wanted to clone myself and they took one of my skin cells and took the nucleus out of there, put it into an enucleated egg and implanted it into a female person, myself or someone else, and it grew to a fully formed human fetus, now it would grow up looking like me, but it wouldn't be me. It would be its own person. But what reasons would there be to do that? You know, with cows, you go, okay, this cow produces great milk, so I'm going to clone it and have this entire herd of cows that produce tons of really good milk, and that's going to be great.
Of course, my identical twins could exchange kidneys and
yes, they can.
Stuff like that without
yes, they
any
can.
Problem.
Yeah. Yes.
Or bone marrow.
That's absolutely correct. And they don't all come down with the same diseases. So, for instance, I have a colleague who is an identical twin, and she, at an earlier age in her teens, developed a blood disorder that was treatable for a long time, but then became more serious in the last couple of years. And she needed to have stem cells from bone marrow. She needed that kind of transplant. And she has an identical twin. So she got it from her twin, and she's cured. But her twin did not develop that same disease. So even if you're genetically identical, not all identical twins will develop the same type of cancer, for instance. One may come down with leukemia and the other does not.
I guess one of the things we've heard enough, you know, I'm not sure if it's true enough, but is the fear that maybe somebody like a Hitler, for example, might try to, although it would take a long time, you know, you actually select particular characteristics, or you would select characteristics so that the overall intelligence of the population was greater, or something like that.
Yeah, that's a little bit about what we talked about yesterday in the session on genetic screening and genetic selection, where at the blastocyst stage you can screen for the presence or absence of certain types of genetic spellings in different genes. And I think on the whole intelligence thing, there's so little known about how the brain develops and how those cells communicate and how genes are turned off or on and how much of that is genetic and how much of that is environment. But yeah, and that's something that definitely people think about. And but at this point, and maybe that would maybe never even be possible, because so much of intelligence is also your environment. What kind of stimulation do you receive when you're from a baby on, right? The brain is still developing after birth, very, very much so. So it's not, you know, some of it's genetic, it's not all genetic. And those first few years are extremely important in brain development. And even, you know, more recent research has shown that the teenage brain is still not completely formed, and there's a lot going on in there. And a lot of the energy is spent in sort of the creative, more brainstem part, and not so much in the frontal cortex where you make rational decisions, which, you know, is good to know. I've got an 11-year-old, so I have to remember that. Some of the reason they do stupid things is because, or make bad decisions, is because a lot of their brain energy is not up here, it's back here.
Well, my wife has taught school for a number of years now. She's an assistant principal, and she's, from her observations and stuff, she says that well, we're from Texas, okay, and so there's this push to have state, and it actually has a statewide test that says if people before they graduate or make a transition, like whatever, 7th, 8th grade or whatever. And, but some of the mathematical things that are on those tests, in her opinion, are way beyond brain development of that age group, because it involves rationale, reasoning, and so forth, which doesn't really fully come, well, not, maybe not fully, but doesn't develop much later in terms of either high school or even college. So, you know.
So, what I think it's reasonable to ask the question, is there any ethically acceptable reason to clone a human? You know, there are a lot of questions aside from what reasons would there be. What would the parenthood of that clone be? They wouldn't have parents in quite the same sense that we all have parents, a mother and father, right? So if I clone myself, the biological parents of that clone would be my parents, who may or may not be around at that point. So who would parent that clone? You know, would it be me? Would it be, it's just something
that
to think about.
Is that also an issue in vitro fertilization, or is that more just?
Well, in vitro fertilization involves the sperm and the egg of two different individuals, so there is a biological mother and father. But the people who raise that child, the child resulting from that, may or may not be the biological parents, right? So in some cases where there's female infertility, you may require donation of an egg from an egg donor. Or if there's infertility on the side of the male partner, you may get sperm from a sperm bank. So those are issues that those individuals have to deal with as they grow up, that they're biological parents. And it could be, you know, it's sort of similar for adoption as well. Your biological parents are not the ones that are raising you, and do you have a right to seek out your biological parents? Do you have a right to know what their genetic information is, predisposition towards diseases, or, you know, if you ever need a bone marrow transplant or some kind of transplant, do you have the right to find out who your biological parents are so that you can try and better find a match, say if you need a kidney or something? If your biological parents aren't the parents that are raising you, those parents are probably not going to be a match. Or any of your siblings if they come from other, you know, biological parents. Who would the clone's family be? You know, who would raise that clone? And what are the expectations of this clone? If I clone myself just because I think my DNA is really great, and it shouldn't be allowed to expire upon my death. What kind of expectations does that put? Or, I love my father very much, and of course he's not going to live forever. He dies, and before he dies, I take some cells and use them to make a clone of him. What kind of expectations does it put on that person that results from that cloning? Is it ethical to put expectations like that on somebody? I created you because I didn't want my father's DNA, his unique genetic composition, to die. Is human cloning a loving thing to do? Some questions that are from a real ethical base. The ELCA has a paper called Human Cloning, Papers from a Church Consultation. And so this is a number of essays by theologians and medical doctors, research scientists, a number of ministers, etc., a number of people that debate a number of issues around cloning. And I'm going to read a quote from Hans Teufel, who's a professor of religion and ethics at the College of William and Mary in Virginia. And this is fairly representative of what most of the people say in this document. And this can be obtained from the ELCA if you go to elca.org. It's put out by the Division for Church and Society, and you can obtain a copy if you want to read it. So he says, "My conclusion is that we should oppose human cloning on moral grounds. Such begetting gives too much control to the begetters over the begotten. Thereby, cloning deprives the child of too much, two parents and two lineages and a unique start in life that is not overshadowed by an existing physical identity carefully chosen and already designated with an identity and human image. Such a lot in life is too heavy, constraining, and cruel for any child. By contrast, the image to which biblical believers testify and to which the child should aspire offers a choice rather than a fate. And while the divine image also imposes a burden, that weight is light, freely born, and genuinely loving." So that's it. Now, everyone in here says we should not clone humans for a variety of different reasons, and different people debate different sides of the different parts of the issue or different ethical questions that arise. But the overall conclusion is human cloning is not, there's no good reason to do it, essentially, cloning an entire human being. They're not against necessarily stem cell research, which could lead to cures for grievous illness, etc. And this is an article published in the Journal of Lutheran Ethics, September 2001, by James Childs, Reverend James Childs, who's the Joseph A. Sittler Professor of Theology and Ethics at Trinity Lutheran Seminary and Director for ELCA Studies on Sexuality. So I'm just going to read part of this. The question, "Where do you stand?" And this is the title of the article, is "Where do you stand? Perspectives on the ethics of stem cell research." The question, "Where do you stand?" is not simply a question of your ethical convictions on this matter. It is also a question about your location, the vantage point from which you look at this question. Certainly people with Parkinson's disease, families with loved ones in the grip of Alzheimer's disease, and others beset with end-stage kidney disease, certain forms of cancer or liver failure, are likely to see the promise of embryonic stem cell research as a virtual godsend. Even if it is too late for them or for their loved ones, their experience with these fatal and debilitating diseases evokes a compassionate advocacy for this work to go forward. Just as surely, the scientists who have these diseases in their crosshairs are eager to forge ahead, whether out of an authentic vocational drive to combat disease and death, or the thrill of the hunt and the glory of the prize, or both. From this vantage point, the road ahead seems clear. Yet there are also folks, including some whose lives have been touched by dread diseases or who are in the healing arts, who stand in a different location on what they might call the higher ground of the sanctity of human life. For them, the destruction of embryonic life for the advance of medicine is a Faustian bargain. In many, if not the overwhelming majority of instances, this belief in the inviolable sanctity of life in all its phases is driven by religious convictions employed in the interpretation of the scientific data of human genesis. From this vantage point, the road ahead is a dead end. For both camps, pro and con, then, there is yet another location to consider, one that is raised when we invoke the sanctity of life principle in this debate. Where do you locate yourself on the question of when life begins? This is a centuries-old question, so central to the endless debate over abortion. The varieties of answers given throughout the tradition of Christian moral reflection represent a broad spectrum, to say the least. And they go on to discuss the various pros and cons. Where does the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America locate itself in the midst of this debate? First of all, it is fair to say that our people look at this from the various vantage points we can discern in the general population. However, we do have a common place from which to begin our moral deliberation. The document, A Social Statement on Abortion, adopted by the Churchwide Assembly in 1991, operates with the following conviction: human life in all phases of its development is God-given, and therefore has intrinsic value, worth, and dignity. One could readily infer from this statement a moral prohibition of research with embryonic stem cells. However, the Social Statement on Abortion does not make absolute prohibitions. It recognizes some dire circumstances in which abortion is a responsible, albeit tragic, choice. Thus, we have to deal with the question of whether or not the fetal tissue involved in such cases might not be donated to stem cell research, and if not, why not? Is this morally different from donating organs of those who are brain dead and about to be taken off fetal life supports? Okay, and then I'm going to skip some of it. Later on, he also states, we will want to advocate for the research with stem cells from umbilical cords and adult sources. However, we should be aware that this is not the easy way out. At present, though the jury is still out, scientists see differences in adult stem cells and embryonic stem cells that seem to favor the latter in their potential for a variety of therapeutic applications. Adult stem cell research may not show results anytime soon that will relieve the pressure to work with embryonic tissue. Finally, there is another vantage point from which to view the matter. It is the vantage point of justice. With over 43 million people without health insurance, how do we set priorities in the allocation of funds spent in medicine? Will the benefits of this stem cell research continue to be unevenly shared, as with other benefits of medical science? It is vexatious to consider saying no to any pursuit that we think will relieve suffering or cure disease. However, given the system we have chosen for the delivery of health care, we do de facto. It is within this larger context that we must also consider the relative value of a controversial issue such as stem cell research. So, you know, there are a lot of conflicts even within a denomination. You know, there's still a lot of sides to the issue and not, you know, just one dictum, this is okay and this is not. And that's probably appropriate. I mean, some of these things you need to be taken on a case-by-case basis in some respects. And you can see from the parts of that article that I read that adult stem cells would be far more palatable or desirable than embryonic stem cell research, but that even embryonic stem cell research is not exactly the same, perhaps, as abortion. And there's just a wide variety of feelings, even within, you know, within the denomination. So there are various articles like this that set forth a lot of what is felt by people in the ELCA, and probably, you know, Catholic groups and groups of other faiths have similar statements. There's still a lot of debate.
Back to human cloning, are there people who say that it should be done, and if so, what's their rationale?
In the case of the South Korean scientists, their statement is it should only be done to generate stem cells. I haven't really heard anyone articulate publicly that it should be done to create fully formed fully developed humans. But it would not surprise me if someone was trying to do that because they felt that there was money to be made. You know, if they felt like there would be a market out there for people who wanted cloned individuals, their relatives or, you know, their child that died prematurely, those kind of things. So, you know, sometimes things get done just to see if you can do them, right? Which is not, perhaps, definitely not the best reason to use for doing anything. Let's just do it to see if we can do it. But that certainly happens in science as well as in other professions. And so I wouldn't be surprised if there were research organizations, probably privately funded, that were trying to do exactly that. Institutions run by someone interested in eugenics, you know, want to develop people with all the good traits and not the bad traits, you know, good and bad being decided by whoever runs that institution.
I think you covered this the other day, but I've forgotten. What is the difference between a stem cell from a fetus, say, and a stem cell from an umbilical cord? And what's their usefulness? How is the usefulness different?
Well, they're very similar. So umbilical cord stem cells, umbilical vein stem cells, are very immature stem cells from the fetus, but they're not, at least as far as we understand now, they can be used to reconstitute, say, the blood. You know, they're part of the blood cell lineage. So you can use those to repopulate all the cells, all the various cells that are from the bone marrow. So they get used to treat leukemia often, or other types of genetic diseases of blood cells.
So they're a little more specialized.
A little more specialized, yes.
Does a parent have to agree that the cord be used scientifically?
Yeah, yes.
Okay.
Yes. And I think sometimes now people are even given the option, do you want to freeze your umbilical vein blood when your child is born? I wasn't offered that choice when I had my kids, but from leading these sessions and talking to other people I know of people who were offered that choice for several thousands of dollars to have those cells frozen down in case that child became sick with a you know, leukemia or some other disease of the blood cells later, that they could use, in fact, their own stem cells as a treatment. And I know scientists actually who froze their own child's umbilical cord blood kind of on their own in the lab because they have access to, you know, the kind of equipment to do that, just in case.
When you talk about perhaps privately funded groups are trying to do human cloning, in my mind that sounds like mad scientist stuff.
Well, yeah, it does.
Yeah.
Why, you know, why would they? It's not the same as making, say, chimeric organisms. So that's a mixture of two genomes where, you know, like a person with the head of an eagle and the tail of a crocodile,
yeah,
things like that. That's a very sort of out there on that scale image. But people with genes from some other organism, for instance, and this happens in animal research, there's a gene from algae that, so there's some bioluminescent algae, right, and there are certain genes in the genome of those algae that produce the protein that's luminescent, and it gets called GFP, green fluorescent protein. And we use that in research a lot, because if you're putting your gene of interest into a cell, how do you know that gene got in there? Okay, if it produces a surface protein and you have an antibody to that, you can detect it. But what if it's some protein that stays within the cell? You don't, it's difficult to, but if you put that gene in there, we use these little circular pieces of DNA called plasmids a lot of times to get genes into cells. So if you put on the plasmid your gene of interest, as well as the gene for this green fluorescent protein, and then you put that into the cells, then the cells are green. They glow green under fluorescent light, and you can, so then you can tell that your gene got in there. So that's just for research purposes. But they have made a monkey and also mice that have cells that have the green fluorescent protein in them. So it's, you know, they've got DNA from this algae in their nuclei.
Do they glow in the dark?
In some circumstances, yes. It depends which cell, whether all cells have that gene or just some of them. So in the case of some of the mice, only the macrophages, which is a certain type of white blood cell, have the gene for green fluorescent protein. And so that helps you trace those macrophages and where they go and what kind of tissues they go into and what they might be doing. Because that's a population that's a very small population, and it's hard to trace. And if you want to look in live tissue, having that fluorescent light being produced helps you trace that. And it's also being used for visualizing cancers. So you can take cancer cells and inject them into mice and have them grow into tumors. And then you can visualize those tumors with a special machine that that measures the fluorescent light coming from those tumors. And that light is strong enough, depending on where the tumor is, to penetrate the skin. Apparently it works better in a white mouse than a black mouse. So the white hair allows the light out better than the black-haired mouse, which also has a darker skin. But so you can visualize those tumors, and then you can do treatments and see whether the tumors shrink or not without killing the animal, which is how you had to do that before. You had to sacrifice the animal, pull out the tumor, measure it and weigh it, whereas now you can image the mouse over and over again without harming it. And so that's a hopeful thing, that those kind of things could be used in humans, where you could tag the tumor cells in a human with some sort of fluorescent protein, and then as you treat the person, you can measure whether the tumor has shrunk in size in a much less invasive way than before. So there's an instance where some animals have been created that have the gene from another species in them. It's not as dramatic as, you know, like an entire part of their body being from some other organism. But that's a chimera, essentially. They have DNA from another organism. And plants, there's been a lot of controversy in the plant world. If you put a gene from another organism into a plant that makes it resistant, say, to a certain pest, genetically engineered foods. Is that safe? Do we know if that's safe? Is it okay to do that? A lot of ethical questions. What, can you guarantee that those plants are only going to reproduce with themselves and their pollen's not going to be carried on the wind and reproduce with somebody else's corn or whatever? So we'll move over time. Thanks for coming. Feel free to ask.